What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program that provides a forum for teens and other folks to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Established in 1963, Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratories is an independent, nonprofit organization that provides marine life to schools and research laboratories worldwide. Working out of the back of a rusted 1957 Plymouth station wagon, Jack Rudlow started GSML. We are so glad to have him. I am excited as I can be. I have to just interrupt here before we even get started and talk about going to his lab. It was just really very, very interesting for me. And I have two students that I want to give special kudos to because I know it's a difficult time for you all, and I appreciate you coming out, and that is Gavin Dunsby. He is a student at Sale. He's in the ninth grade, and he's into reading and random historical facts and comic books.
Hello.
And we have Hannah Kuros. She's a regular. She's from Rickards in the IB program. She's into programming and biology.
Hi. Thanks.
And last but not least, we have Jack Rudlow.
Hello.
I am so glad to have him again. He is the author and co-author of 9 books, both fiction and nonfiction. He's written numerous scientific articles and technical publications. And so to speak, he's a homeboy. He lives in Panacea. He's been there over 50 years or so. And we are just excited to have you. Jack, you are truly fascinating. I mean, too bad this is radio, because he came in and he had these two horseshoe crabs. And everybody in the radio station gravitated toward, what does he have? So, I appreciate you coming. How did your interest in biology and marine biology, how did that evolve?
Oh, gosh, Liz, I don't know. I think it came from practically birth on. You know, I was a kid in Brooklyn, New York, and fortunately I was very fortunate that I lived across the street from a thing called Prospect Park. But here was this urban environment, and I didn't know it at the time, but this great, wonderful Prospect Park was once just a cow pasture, and this great architect, Ulfield, basically reshaped it as he did Central Park and that sort of thing. So I grew up basically picking crawfish out of the stream there. I didn't know that the stream, of course, was an artificial man-made thing until later on. I went back years later and saw there were pumps and there were, you know, all the other things like that and all these sort of life support systems there and chasing butterflies up in hills and grasshoppers, all of which man-made. But nature comes in and takes over, and I was just, you know, I had turtles when I was a kid, and they used to, you know, at the time they had Empire State Buildings and things painted on the back of them, and unfortunately there's a salmonella scare that came along a few years ago and said thou shalt not keep little turtles, which I think is one of the worst things that's ever happened, because, you know, people can connect with nature, and turtles are one of the great things. And at Gulf Specimen, we do a lot of sea turtles. We have sea turtle rehabs, and we have turtles, you know, in tanks that we are bringing around from being hooked and other things. But it all came out of New York as a kid, and what came out of this whole thing was just a driving interest in nature and just life's live things, sensitive plants that you thump and the leaves closed up and, you know, they're still out there. I still play with them. So it's really you follow, you know, your bliss. You follow your love of something, and that's what you go with. And that's how that sort of got started.
Gavin, I know you had a question earlier that I told you to hold. Do you want to pose it now?
Yeah. How long have you been a marine biologist?
Well, there would be some people that say, I am not a marine biologist. I have no degree. Oh, of course, Leon High School, I did finally fight my way, struggled for Leon High and had 3 months of college. And then I got liberated from FSU. And And it went on from there. And then I have paid the price much for that because I've spent the last 50 years studying and researching and that sort of thing of learning all marine biology and that kind of thing. But you could say my marine biology started when I first even before I moved to Florida, and I was in Coney Island in Brooklyn, and I'd walk along and there were horseshoe crabs on the beach and there were sponges and other things. And when I moved down here, you know, I just went ballistic. There was just all kinds of wonderful things up on the shores, and there were, you know, sea hares, and we'd call them inkfish, and I was just curious. And the first time I went out on a shrimp boat, maybe that's when I became a marine biologist, and I saw, you know, the nets come up, and they dumped it out on deck, and the shrimp are flopping and jumping around and jackknifing, and there's moray eels all speckled and black and white and teeth, and octopuses crawling around, and squid, and stuff I'd read about and dreamed about. And then, you know, even as a kid, I used to go to the library and I would read books on turtles by, you know, Archie Carr, who was the great turtle biologist. And that was – suddenly I'm in Florida and I'm get a chance to meet Archie Carr and Ross Allen, which was the Reptile Institute. And I read his books, and then suddenly I'm meeting Ross Allen. It was just like going to heaven, you know. So I don't know. When did I become a marine biologist? Either never or practically from birth. It's your interest that counts, and that's what you want to do.
You have any other questions?
Not a question so much. I'm just a little bit like in awe that I'm next to the person.
Please don't be in awe, okay?
I did Saturday at the Sea when
yes.
I was the camp when
it's
I was
a good
I think,
program, yes.
Yeah, in maybe eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And I've been a condensed matter research assistant at the Mag Lab for a while, and I've been working with a physicist there. And I love the work that I'm doing, and I think that it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But like being on a boat and actually being able to interact with the organisms was so cool.
That's
because
right.
The work that I do at the Mag Lab is very theoretical, and I really enjoy that. But I don't know, like when you brought the horseshoe crabs in.
They're real, right?
Yeah, it makes you realize, wow, there's, I don't know, nature's around me. I'm a part of nature. There's
exactly.
It makes you realize, I think, that everything around you is like fluid and living, and there's really interesting things outside of like humanity that are going on right now. And I think it's cool. I like the work that you're doing a lot.
Well, you know, that really encourages me and makes me feel wonderful, because that is the purpose of Gulf Specimen, and that's what it was. When I came out with this interest as a child, and I was attracted to life, just pure life. All we do is showcase life. It is not my charming personality, I promise you. A lot of people say it's not very charming.
It is.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well, if you were a land developer and you're pushing down trees and you're destroying the area and driving down seawalls and saying screw nature and stuffing it down, you wouldn't find me a very nice person, okay? You know, and one of the great achievements of my life. I went to Madagascar in 63, 64, and I was on the International Indian Ocean Expedition. And one of the things that I collected then for the Smithsonian was a jellyfish. And it was a box jellyfish, a stinging jellyfish at the time. And just the last couple of years, the researcher was going through the collections, and they found this thing in formaldehyde, 50 years plus, you know, old. And he said, hey, wait a minute, this is different. This is another species. This is and it's new to science. So they named it Chiracella rudlowi. Yep. And to me, that is my greatest honor. And I've had isopods and other creatures named, you know, but to have a box stinging jellyfish that will, you know, light up your life if you touch one of these things in the wrong way or it hits you in the back or something like that is, many say, fits my personality entirely. So so that I don't know where we got off into that. But anyway, you know, I'm very passionate about nature. I have fought for nature. I have fought many politicians. I have gone to the legislature. Those people work for us. They are breathing, whether they believe it or not, and they don't seem to this day and age, the same air that we're breathing, the same water. And all of them, like everybody else, is getting cancer, and the environment is getting polluted, and the biodiversity is shrinking, and these people are living in this fantasy land of their power and their wealth and their control, and they're insane. You know, they're just totally nuts that think that they can just do what they can do and pollute the environment and sit there and think their self-importance is going to, you know, do it, you know. My wife of 41 years was a marine biologist, and you know, we worked on cancer research. We helped discover drugs and everything else. Well, she died of cancer 5 years ago, you know, and it's real. It's there. Mm-hmm. And I've seen desperately poor people die of it, and I've seen extremely wealthy, powerful people. So wake up out there, you know. The other day I was on the March for Science, and I was, you know, pleased to be asked one of the four speakers to go stand on the Capitol steps and talk about the importance of science and the insanity of our politicians right now to turn their back on it and to deny science and everything else. And I'm standing there looking up at this giant Tower of Babel behind me and thinking, these people have lost their connection with the real world, with nature and with the importance, and are turning us into a sewer. And they're basically screwing the kids. That's it. You guys are the ones that are going to have to deal with these people that are just blind and greedy. And when they say, give me the green of the dollar or the green of the tree, and we'll take the dollar every time, you know. What your answer is, buzz off, you know. That's the way you have to be. And you get your passion. I get my passion through nature, through the nudibranchs and the sea slugs and the squid and the stuff and these horseshoe crabs and everything else. Because remember, Star Trek or Star Wars, Yoda. Where did Yoda get his power? Yoda's sitting in a swamp, you know, with snakes and other creepy crawlers. And yet he can take his finger and lift the spaceship out of the mud because his forces come from nature. So, you know, that's where this comes from.
Wow. That's just – yes. Well, you asked your question, but we're going to take a break in a few seconds so you can ask it and then we'll think about it. Or you have a comment, would you have? No, oh, you were just doing the sign. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I couldn't see. I thought that's what it was. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are talking with Jack Rutlow. The GSML is a major interactive nature center. And when we come back, we'll give you all the details about where it is, where it's located, and how you can connect. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. And again, I welcome Jack Rutlow. I'm so glad to have him here. He is with Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratories, and I have two students, two of my regulars, Gavin Dunsby, and he goes to Sail, and I have Hannah Kiros, and she goes to Rickards. So I'm glad to have you both back. Jack, first of all, share with us, walk us through the Gulf Specimen Marine Lab. Start by telling us where it is, okay? So if people who are listening would like to check it out, they will be fascinated. They will be mesmerized. Believe me, old, young, it doesn't matter, okay?
Okay, right. First, I want to say we're going to have our annual fundraiser on May 20th, 4 to 7, on Sharks in Chablis. And our guest speaker there is going to be Joel Satori, who is the originator of the photo ARC. He's from National Geographic, and he has done this great book with all these hundreds of creatures in it, and he's taken hundreds of pictures at Gulf Specimen, and then he's gone all over the world to get rhinoceroses and all sorts of, you know, monkeys and other creatures, which is in this book, The Photo ARC. And I'm very delighted that he was kind enough to include me, and my late wife is a National Geographic hero for our environmental, you know, battles and trying to teach. It was a shack in the woods, and that's what I started this thing with, you know. And I had just come back from Madagascar, which I'd bluffed my way into. I was the youngest member of the expedition. But I was the president of Gulf Specimen Company, by the way, which was a box of stationery, an old car, and an Airedale. And basically evolved this place, learning how to pump seawater into tanks, how to try to keep things alive, how to find things, how to ship them, how to sell them to schools and research labs. And then what happened is strange things happened is people would meet me on the beach, a teacher now and then, and say, hey, can I see what you're doing with this stuff? And I'd show them my shack that I was there, and I had tanks with, you know, wooden plywood tanks with water in them, and I was learning in the process, and they say, can I bring my class back? So next thing you know, we'd have classes and schools, and Sop Choppy's school and that kind of thing. And next thing you know, there were more and more. And when my wife got involved in this thing, she said, you know, this is only going to get more and more. So we created this nonprofit organization, and which is the Gulf Specimen Aquarium and Marine Lab. And basically opened it up and just started showcasing life. It's like the thing you were talking about, how it was the life that is around you. And so we have tanks and aquariums, and we have, you know, some large tanks that have sea turtles in them and sharks and octopuses. Couldn't get Holly to hold the octopus. That's the one thing she balked at. She just absolutely refused.
I was like, no way.
Yeah. We tried.
I did try.
Yes.
But they weren't interested, and I was glad.
Well, we've had octopuses there where you put your hands in, and they will come up and hold hands with you.
That's more
bizarre in your lifetime. People have told me just the single touch of an octopus holding your hand with all those tentacles and sucker discs changes their life forever. So, you know, it's there. So nature connects and that kind of thing. So over the years, we've kind of built up Gulf Specimen. Since we're nonprofit, we've managed to get some donations from time to time, and we still need donations. But bear in mind that we are a standalone organization. We are not part of Florida State University. We are not part of TCC. We're not part of anything. We stand alone. Now, the disadvantage of that is money roars through pipelines and belches from the legislature down into the universities and the academics, and that's how this building is here and so on. But we're lucky if we get a drip now and then or a leak or something of that sort. But there's a price that goes for being independent. But I'll say to you and anybody else in this thing, education is great and it's important and it is good, but it is not necessarily critical. Education and universities and schools and high schools and all that. I mean, I barely escaped from high school, okay? I got out with a C average, and it was C minus, and it was a big job to get that. I survived 3 months of Florida State University when Parnell was announced that I was – the dean suggested that I was not college material, and he was right, okay? He suggested I dig ditches. I was offended, but I can't tell you how many ditches I've dug laying pipelines and everything else like that, sitting in the sun swatting flies and that sort of thing and learning engineering. But, you know, I'm just afraid that we as a society say to kids, if you don't have an education and you don't go to college, you're done for. You're just on the scrap heap. That is baloney. The thing is what you've got to do and ask yourself right now, what am I interested in? What do I want to do? Don't think about it. Just ask it. Shoot from the hip. Bang. And then I promise you, whatever it is you really want to do in your guts, that's where your direction is, and that's what you want to do.
That's good advice. I think that sounds as if it would be very easy to follow, but I think the trajectory of like – matriculating from high school to college, then grad school provides like security. So you can go through the motions without really thinking about what the overarching end goal is, or whether your interests align with it, or whether what you're doing will have any good net benefit.
Let me tell you something, okay? First of all, when you step out on your own and do something like that, it's terrifying. It really is, you know. I mean, one of the most scary things I ever did was when Leon High School was over and I'm out there and what do I do next, you know. And that's what we are all doing. But let's take Gulf Specimen. It exists now. We have interns from Florida State, sometimes TCC, sometimes high school kids and everything else. Now, me personally, I am a hardcore unemployable. I would be one of these people that they would say is a throwaway from society. Right. Okay. But people that work at Gulf Specimen and volunteer and put in the hours, they've been knocking down jobs one right after the other. Snap, snap, snap. Mm-hmm. I mean, because they work at Gulf Specimen. But, you know, I knew one of my mentors in life was John Steinbeck, who was the great novelist and writer and everything
else.
So
cool, man.
All right. So when I first met him in New York and I went up there to see him and that stuff. And he was just an intriguing guy. But I was talking about, you know, starving and not being able to do anything. And I said, well, what's the chance of getting a grant? And he said, you'll never get a grant. He said, you can try. He says he tried to get a grant when he was starving and he could never get a grant. But all the people that have actually been studying Steinbeck and written theses and dissertations and all that stuff have been grants and gone all over the world and everything else. Steinbeck couldn't get a grant. That's what he told me. So, you know, it's not as a critique of the society and says it's terrible. It's just that some people can get out on their own, work at it. You know, what Steinbeck told me, I said, well, I really wanted to be a writer and everything else. And he said, good. Write your first 1,000,000 words. When you finish 1,000,000 words, he says, you will be well on your way to being a writer. And I said, published words, you know? And he said, no, just write your first 1,000,000 words. Well, from that, I was able to publish books and articles in National Geographic and Sports Illustrated and Smithsonian Magazine. And I had a life of hopping around doing this. And my wife used to call it living on lily pads because like a frog jumping from one lily pad to the other. And it was pretty financially insecure. But it was a great life, you know. And but that was because what was the driving force for her and for me, which was nature.
That's really cool. I think that the idea of like striking out on your own is like very, very horrifying to me. But obviously, like, I think to achieve great things, you have to some degree, you know, be an individualist and be a little bit rugged.
Yes.
So I mean, it's really, really admirable.
Yes. And where, if you're successful in striking out on your own, I guarantee you will get enemies. So, but, you know,
that goes with it.
That goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
But your interest in what you want to achieve personally is what really counts, and that's what you got to do.
Kevin, did you?
It's kind of a question. How old do you have to be to volunteer at your lab?
That's a good question. I think it's 16. We have a volunteer coordinator that actually handles this, and I'm...
And what's the number? How would someone contact?
Okay, you call 850-984-5297 and just say you're interested in volunteering or, for those that can, donating or whatever, or becoming a membership or whatever else it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what we go for really is interest first. You know, the kids that come down and work and volunteer are the ones that really want to do it, and they might find themselves scrubbing tanks out or even, you know, digging mud out of a tank or something like that, but fun things like scrubbing the algae off a sea turtle and even helping, you know, tag turtles and that kind of thing. Or, you know, one day, hey, we got to move the sharks from this tank and then pressure wash that tank and it's dirty, muddy stuff. But they love it. And every one of the kids that's been doing this, and I say kids, you know, we also have, you know, retired volunteers that are doing it, an architect, and we've had people with computer backgrounds and that sort of thing. And it amazes me it's working. I mean, sometimes I go up there and there's tour buses up there and there's thousands of kids just going through the lab on field trips. So I'm sure many of you listening to this will say, oh, yeah, I've been there on a field trips, and I've been this, that, the other. But, we're getting there someplace when I can't find a parking spot to get in there myself and have to, walk
that
to the
says
box.
Something.
And that happens sometimes. So we're very happy when that does.
Did you have any other?
Kind of. What is the longest living specimen you have?
Longest living specimen we have? That's a good question. It could be a sponge.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
That's cool.
It could be, a sea turtle is the obvious one that, everybody says lives for supposedly 100 years. That's very questionable whether that really does or not. But, who can really follow anything around in the ocean? Now, how long does it live in our tanks? That's another issue. And we hope we can keep it going as long as we can. But, boy, once in a while, something terrible happens, like a pump breaks down in the middle of the night, and next to the oxygen goes down, and you lose stuff, and we almost lost our sharks. So now we've just spent $4,000 on getting modern things that will start ringing people's cell phones off the hook if the pumps go down, and things of that sort, using technology and that stuff and communication. That's another thing I wanted to mention is that technology reminds me. All right. When I was first starting this and I'd go out on the shrimp boat and I'd see the blob on the beach and I'd see all these creatures there, I didn't know what these things were. I kind of got to the library. I was struggling trying to get information out of Florida State University, which wasn't always easy. And now I'm jealous of you guys because I see something there. I just go to Mother Google and blap and say it looks like this and that and the other. And all of a sudden I hit images and there's sea hares from all over the world. And I'm sitting there looking at this stuff and click, click, click. And the knowledge is just spewing out. And it was blood for me to get a lot of that stuff. That's how I got my Harvard education and Yale education and all that. I used to load critters into the car and drive them up to Boston or to New Haven, Connecticut, or the American Museum and say, what's this stuff? And I got – they were so delighted with getting stuff from the Gulf of Mexico because the Gulf of Mexico was the moon to them. They thought – well, like Francis Beebe was the man who helped invent the bathysphere that was this ball that dropped down into the ocean. And I met him at – we'd have afternoon teas at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. And he was arguing with me that horseshoe crabs only got down to, North Carolina. They didn't make it – he didn't think they made it into the Gulf of Mexico until I showed him some. But that's how hard it was to get information and to learn. But then to talk to somebody like Francis Beebe when he's talking about being down and seeing a green turtle 800 feet down as this ball is lowered down from a ship. Now we have submersibles and they can go down and cameras on the bottom and all of that stuff. So believe me, I love the technology that's there. But the technology is only a tool. And what really counts is you, your interest, being here, and that kind of thing.
Well, Jack, you've been a strong advocate and proponent of, environmental issues. What would you identify as some of the major marine biology environmental issues today, particularly of our area?
Water pollution and that stuff. I'll tell you, there was a wonderful thing that happened when I said I was on the steps of the Capitol and for the March of Science. Jim Stevenson, who was, in the parks department in the state and everything else, is a big champion of Wakulla Springs. And I have to say Wakulla Springs has been very special to me because as a kid in Brooklyn, I watched The Creature from the Black Lagoon and next thing I know, I moved down to where the creature's home is, all right? He's still one of my mottos. But my wife had been a champion of Wakulla Springs. And when I gave my – there were four people giving their presentations, okay? And the person right before me was Jim Stevenson. And he pulls out a letter from my wife in 1987, of which she was a call to arms and says, Wakulla Springs is being polluted. There's algae growing on the grass. The water clarity is going down. And this is, you know, the whole world was saying, oh, the pristine Wakulla Springs and the glass bottom boats, which were no longer working and all that. And she said, this is getting polluted. There's sewage runoff from the spray fields and all of this stuff. And this is really bad. And this is what I'm watching. And I'm asking the water management district and whatever it was, DER or whatever it was called at the time, as a call to arms to do something about that. And that is one of the biggest problems. So there it was recognized. And I must admit it broke me up pretty bad to hear her letter being read and about to talk in the Capitol. So, but I did, and I was talking about the need to really deal with water quality. And wetlands and habitats need to be protected. Unfortunately, Wakulla County voted down their wetland ordinance and repealed it because it interferes with developers and speculators. But at the same time, you know, people are having a growing appreciation for nature, and we have to get that appreciation. We had the Rock the Dock Festival down there, and someone told there were 1,600 entries of people madly going out and fishing and trying to catch fish. Well, I'm sorry, they need to know, and they don't think in these terms when they're fishing, because then we all get fish brains and we got to catch fish. But nevertheless, like fish have to catch fish. The idea is those fish are eating other fish. So those fish are eating – and a speckled trout is eating anchovies. Those anchovies are eating plankton. That plankton comes from a barnacle. That comes from a diatom, a little microscopic plant that the barnacle is eating. Food chains, connections, all of these types of things. So as we see the biodiversity shrink, we're losing things. I'll take sand dollars. You like sand dollars? Aren't they pretty?
Let me ask you to hold your thoughts. We'll come back to sand dollars in a minute. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This hour, we're honored to feature Jack Rudlow, founder of Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratories. Did you know Jack began his career as an environmental activist at the age of 8 by biting the leg of a camp counselor who was about to kill a turtle with a sledgehammer? Jack, it's back to you. Talk about the sand dollars.
What about the sand dollars, though?
We'll get on the sand dollars. Okay. I just had to add that in there.
Well, I'm so
awesome.
Yes, I loved it. Yes, I've been biting turtle killers ever since. But we're talking about sand dollars a little while ago.
Right.
Okay. First of all, isn't that one of the prettiest images that we have in the ocean? We have radial symmetry, and of course, when we see them often, they're bleached white, and they're really pretty. Okay. So when I was used to go on shrimp boats, and we had our own shrimp boat for a while and that stuff, and you'd drop the nets down off Alligator Point, if you didn't set your doors right and your chains and that sort of thing and you dragged heavy, your entire net would be bogged down in hundreds of thousands of sand dollars. You could barely lift the net up with all the machinery and get it on deck, and actually if you kept dragging, it would erode and tear the bottom of the net out, and it would just grind it out with the sheer weight of the sand dollars. Well, the sand dollars became less and less. But even, you know, I met this really beautiful woman on the beach one time, and she was a model, and she was from telling me she'd been on every beach around the world and Morocco and so on. And she said, but I love Alligator Point because that's the sand dollar beach. That's where you'd walk around on low tide and you'd feel the sand dollars under your feet and that sort of thing. Well, try it now. There aren't any sand dollars there to speak of. You're lucky you get a, you know, 6 or 7 or 10. If we needed 1,000 pounds of sand dollars, what would have been a few hours' work to get 1,000 pounds of sand dollars would take weeks, months, years, or whatever else, because they have vanished. And they have vanished along with a great deal of other marine life that I used to walk along and do the beach. Could I start Gulf Specimen now? No. It takes – we have boats. We have divers. We have everything else that it takes to get this. But when I was a kid walking along those beaches, the sponges, the sea cucumbers, the sea hares, all the things that would wash up, swim up, and everything else was all out there. Now, this is – you can say, so what? But when you see a sea turtle out there, a beautiful green sea turtle festering with fibropapilloma, which is this tumor-like stuff. It grows out of their eyes and their skin and everything else. And more often than not, they wash up dead. We have a lot to worry about. So those people in the big giant Capitol building up there emanating misinformation and wrong thinking down on us is infecting all of us. And if a turtle is getting diseases like that, we've got a turtle right now. I hope you'll come down and see it at Sharks in Chablis. But it's a big loggerhead and it's filled with gas. It can't dive and everything else. And it had pneumonia and it was comatose, but we've been hand feeding it, getting it back. But instead of focusing on why are we, you know, what we're doing and how to make this turtle better, we can ask what made that turtle get sick. And this is about the fourth or fifth loggerhead in the last few weeks that that have come up this way. Some of them have been dead, and this fibropapilloma with the green. This is the canary in the cage with all this biodiversity and life stuff. And we look at cancer rates, like in Wakulla County. I was. Did some study with somebody, and I forget the numbers, but it has been escalating and going up and going up, and it's going over here. We don't have cancer. We have entire cities devoted to cancer treatment. The MD Anderson, you know, all these That's types true. Of things like that. I mean, they're gigantic. Yeah. And fortunately, I, you know, had to go to those things with my wife and that stuff. But where's the cancer prevention center? There's nothing the size of even a little convenience store that says, hey, we help you prevent cancer. This is what the causes of cancer might be. This is what it is. And when you talk to the oncologist, oh, well, we don't really talk about that because there's so many causes. There's no way to look at it. So we're just going to focus on the treatment. Well, I'm sorry. We need you guys, young people and everything else, to stop and say, what is the impact? It's just like there's studies now that are coming out with suntan lotion. Well, why not suntan lotion stops the horseshoe crab eggs from developing? They kill fish. They kill corals. They do other things like that. Mm-hmm. Is anybody going to talk about that? Is anybody going to really make an interest? I've been to the legislature when I'm seeing people trying to get bottle bills in and do something with plastic bags. And in come the lobbyists, and here comes these guys in the suits and ties, and the legislators just fall to their knees and do hosannas and say, welcome, 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 bring forth the money and screw the people. So I'm sorry. The time to deal with those people and allow to deal with our legislatures and regard them as high positions and these are important people, baloney. These are not important people. You are the important people. I am you. The important people. They don't need the deference that they have.
Mm-hmm. Which leads me, as we talk about, you know, the waste, what happens in dead zones? Would you talk about the dead zones in the ocean?
Yes.
These areas that have no oxygen, they support no life, and they seem to be increasing.
They are increasing.
That's why I wanted to have you talk about
that. Now, bear in mind that there have been some natural dead zones, and they do occur from rotting vegetation and other things like that. Mm-hmm. When something rotten decomposes, it will suck up oxygen. Okay. But that's a temporary thing. Mm-hmm. They used to have things called jubilees on the Mobile Coast and that sort of thing where fish and crabs and everything else would be coming up on the beach. That was a natural occurrence of that. But what's been pouring down the Mississippi is hundreds of chemical factories and sewage and every other bad thing, vast amounts of fertilizer from the Midwest. And, you know, it's cheaper just to spill it on your fields and grow things, and if it washes off, who cares? Well, it goes down there and it just builds up, and then it causes – it's a fertilizer. So it causes the plankton out there, the phytoplankton, mm-hmm. to explode, and it grows and grows and grows. And then they reach a point of saturation and they die, and then they sink down to the bottom and they rot, and there goes the oxygen. And it has to do with, you know, summertime temperatures and other things. But it happens so much, and there's so much crud pouring down the Gulf in there that dead zones are becoming more and more common. And they're something we're living with. Now, it's interesting. The shrimpers will actually – they don't seek out the dead zones. They can't catch anything in the dead zones. But at the mm-hmm. edge of the dead zones is where the shrimp are. And okay. the shrimp are eating all that bacteria that's blooming and sucking up the oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so they know when they find the area where the oxygen is low, mm-hmm. and they can even look at the color of the water and that stuff. That's time they get to the edge, drop the nets, and they often do
and
very
well. That's
where
they'll be.
Yeah. So it's nature's tough, and nature will prevail ultimately.
Wow.
One thing that I think is really interesting, or something that I think that the IB program at Rickards does a very good job of doing, is we conducted group four projects at Lake Munson, where we some groups studied the productivity of phytoplankton as an indicator of the lake's health, and my group studied the correlation between the trophic state of a lake and its dissolved oxygen content.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
good.
I took my IB bio exam today, and we've had questions on the use of genetically modified organisms and the ethical implications and the mm-hmm. ecological implications of, like, you know, pollutants and biomagnification. So, and I don't know if that's something that's been consistent in education, like, as time's been going on. But I think my school, at least, has been doing, like, a very good job of making sure that we're environmentally conscious or we fail.
And that's really wonderful. And
yeah.
that really, really is good to know. And, you know, I hope we can – I hope – think I've helped and, you know, my wife and other people have helped contribute to get this interest into the schools. Every time we have a school bus down with school kids – even the little ones, and they're all sitting there saying, you know, where's the shark and I want to play with this crab, everything else like that, and get all excited and all that. That's the first step. Then the next step is to get it into the high schools and to get the interest and understanding of these connections. Connections are the hardest things to make, but obviously it's, you know, your school is making them. And it really bugs me that most schools never even talk about their backyard or where their habitat is or what they live in. And it's not just our schools here. I went up to New York and Brooklyn, and I went back to the junior high school that I was at, and they were just getting into talking about the bay that they were on, where the school was at. But when I was going to school there, nobody even talked about the bay or anything else like that, the Gravesend Bay. It was there. So we need to be teaching. If you're in North Carolina, talk about the mountains. Talk about the connections of the rivers that go down, the streams, and how the streams pour out into the Atlantic or come down into the Gulf. And the seafood mm-hmm. we're going to eat is connected to the trees. When you bring in your big shiny yellow bulldozer up here in Tallahassee or Georgia and you start pushing down the trees and you know, just massacre the whole place, you're really stealing your seafood, because the connections are what are so terribly important. So how does that work? The leaf litter that comes down from the trees basically breaks down into detritus, and that stuff ultimately carries the phytochemicals, big difference. Okay, the plant chemicals tannic acids and just a whole bunch of hundreds of different other types washes down into the sea. That goes out into the creeks, and the creeks into the rivers, and the rivers out into the estuaries, and that is what is fertilizing the phytoplankton out there. Not over-enriching it, but just doing the balance of this God-given connection between plants and the sea and animals in the right balances and the right proportions. And that's where we get our shrimp, the larval shrimp that you need a microscope to look at, that are spawned mm-hmm. 50 miles or 100 miles offshore are following the taste and the scent of the trees that are out there and the phytoplankton, and they're – and then we sit down and have a wonderful shrimp dinner at, you know, Angelo's or Mad Anthony's or whatever.
If you ate seafood.
I eat seafood all the time. Okay. If there's mercury or anything else like that, I'll be dead of it. But I mean, you know, I can't get enough seafood.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Hmm. What's the impact of global warming that you...
That's a tough one. Does it exist? We know rising sea level is existing, or, you know, there is. I'm watching my beaches erode and trees fall into the water, which, of course, become habitats for, you know, other creatures. But nevertheless, doesn't matter. A tree that I've seen have grown up there and just see the getting underwashed, and then the tree crumples down and we see water invading. We see salt getting into freshwater wells. It is, but let's it's probably heresy to say this type of thing, but let's consider that the land that we're sitting on right now, back in the Cretaceous 60 million years ago, was under about 500 feet of water. That in the Jurassic, the Gulf of Mexico connected to the Arctic Ocean through the vast inland sea that was there. You can say this doesn't exist, but the fact is sea level rises and falls much like the tides. The tide comes in, the continent is flooded. The tide goes out, and then we have dry land. Now, in our human time scale, that's hard to conceive of. You know, I mean, all these huge time changes. Actually, I'm working on a novel about this now called Cretaceous Sea, but with about a shrimp boat that gets thrown back to the age of dinosaurs and, and a Coast Guard vessel. And how would they know? But, you know, but the nearest land at the time is 500 miles away up into the North Carolina and the Georgia area and the Piedmont areas, because everything else is drowned. And, you know, at the same time, you know, we humans are reshaping the landscape entirely. We're getting rid of the forest, the trees, everything else. We have rooftops and concrete, and it's growing and it's growing and it's causing its impact. And we act like there's no tomorrow and it's not gonna happen. And I don't know that giving, you know, carbon credits and stuff like that is going to cure it, where you just give people bags of money and say, here, you got, you know, this is a wrong way to do it. But we also do need to see how we can keep our trees, how we can minimize the concrete, how we can, you know, ultimately come up with vehicles that are better and less polluting and that kind of thing. We have an impact, and we need to be striving. But we can't be like this administration that's just blowing it all off and says, the heck with it, and let's strip mine, and let's tear up everything, and let's drill for oil, and let's pollute, and we don't care, and we are in charge, and we have the might and power, and we're going to just run roughshod over everybody, and, you know, we don't need to stand by and do this and let this happen. So my opinion on whatever it was.
I think about overfishing. And when I say overfishing, I always am leaning toward that whole shark finning.
Oh, the shark things. Yeah, that's bad. That's really bad.
Is it?
Okay, yeah. Because sharks, you know.
They are in the food chain, too. That's what I was thinking.
Well, they're critical to the food chain.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, for example, all right, you have, I don't know, a speckled trout or something like that. That gives off 100,000 eggs, pow, in one fell swoop. Okay, but if you have a shark, a sawfish, a stingray, whatever else it is, you have a mother shark and she's got, you know, 6 or 7 or 10 babies inside of her, and she pops them out one at a time, and some, you know, if they're not eating each other inside, with some species do, they're basically producing very few offsprings. So you bring in finning operations and shark operations and all that stuff, and you you basically wipe out big communities of sharks, which are feeding on the weak, the sick. I mean, you know, you won't have dead turtles washing up from being sick because they'll have been munched by sharks. But we have a lot of dead turtles washing up, and, you know, you might see a bite or two on them. In the old days, that would never have happened. They would have been all chomped up. So there's balances and ecosystems where, you know, you need top chain predators to feed on lower – the weaker, the slower, right. that sort of thing. And they keep – they ultimately keep the population strong. And at the same time, you look at other overfishing. Like I used to think, my God, they're going to destroy the shrimp population. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are, we have done wonderful things for certain shrimp populations. Like we have eroded our topsoil and stripped off our land and the mud.
All the, Which is thoughtful of us.
It runs So our topsoil runs down into the Mississippi River and pours out in there. And the brown shrimp say, wonderful. And then they proliferate. And then we have a wonderful shrimp fishery
and
for that.
Jack, I'm going to have to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I want you to speak very quickly about sharks and Chablis because we're running out of time.
Okay. Well, that's very important.
30
seconds.
We
are having our fundraising, Sharks and Chablis. We have entertainment. The tickets are $45. It's a fundraiser, but we have a seafood meal from the Seine Yard restaurant is providing the food. We have lots of exhibits. We have music. Everybody has a ball because everybody gets to meet people they haven't met for years before when they come to these. They're always successful and they're always fun.
And thank you so much. I appreciate it. To my listening audience, thanks for the privilege of your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.